Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, produced on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, November 26, 2011. Here's what we have coming up for you. We start off with an extended news you need to know, which includes some breaking information from Pakistan. Stephen Fowle, editor of the New Hampshire Gazette, reads us the latest fortnightly rant. Then we bring you a Bioneers program of Native people speaking about current issues facing all of us on the planet. They share thoughts and wisdom that they, as Native Americans, can offer the world. We'll also have music and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. This week, focusing on how food and media are used as weapons of war. The U.S. is sparing no expense or principle for its wars. And I'll also cover this breaking news. Pakistan's supply line closed after U.S. kills soldiers again. But first, this from the BBC on November 18th. Why hunger looms in aid-rich Afghanistan. More than 2.5 million people face hunger in drought-stricken parts of Afghanistan, despite billions of dollars of aid that have poured into the country in recent years, aid agencies say. Aid groups say 14 of the country's 34 provinces, most of them in the north, have been hit by severe drought. The UN's World Food Program says harvests in some areas have been almost completely wiped out, doubling the price of wheat and causing other food prices to soar. Some local villagers hear from listening to the radio that large sums of aid have come to Afghanistan, though not to peaceful areas. One villager said, "There is no fighting here, and nobody cultivates poppies. All the international aid seems to go to Kandahar and Helmand. None of it comes here." Aid agencies have been concerned for some time about the amount of aid directed towards conflict areas of Afghanistan. Much of it is designed to win hearts and minds through quick-impact projects in provinces with heavy fighting. According to a U.S. congressional study, 80% of U.S. aid has gone to troubled regions. This policy is defended by the U.S. ambassador to Kabul, Ryan Crocker. But Oxfam's policy and advocacy director in Afghanistan insists that such a policy means that political and military objectives are often being allowed to outweigh humanitarian need. Quote, "These result in schools being built in areas where there are no roads going to them, where needs are not at their greatest, or where there are not enough teachers to staff that school." Other aid agencies, including Save the Children, take a similar view. They say that more long-term development aid is needed, and that blurring the lines between aid work and military objectives puts their staff, as well as the people they help, at more risk. That's because the U.S. is using food as a weapon of war. And from Reuters on November 21st, the U.S. is giving, not selling, 24 F-16 fighter planes to Indonesia to strengthen security ties with an important U.S. partner, the Defense Department said. A Navy spokeswoman said that the advanced fighters will contribute to Indonesia's interoperability with the U.S. Developing ties with Indonesia, the largest country in Southeast Asia, is a priority for the Obama administration, as it seeks to shape the economies and security of the region. With arms transfers come training, closer military establishments, and other ties. President Obama announced the planned F-16 transfer near the end of a Asia-Pacific tour that Obama used to reassert U.S. interests in the region. The transfer of advanced U.S. weapons will help establish a long-term security relationship, partly because the complex technology of U.S. equipment requires regular collaboration between the U.S. and its partners. U.S. assistance creates, quote, "strong incentives for recipient countries to maintain good ties with the United States," said a State Department spokesman. I believe this should be interpreted as part of strategic posturing against China. And now this story from the BBC on November 25th. Which I had to significantly edit down and reorder so that the story would make any sense. Egypt's new prime minister, Kamal Ganzouri, asks for time. He headed Egypt's government from 1996 to 1999 under Mubarak. Many demonstrators have rejected Mr. Ganzouri's appointment. One man in Tahrir Square told Reuters, "For the second time, we are going to depend upon the old guard of Mubarak's regime. Why do we not give the young a chance instead of these people who are 80 years old?" Prime Minister-designate Kamal Ganzouri has asked Egyptians to give me a chance as tens of thousands rally in Cairo against the military rulers. Protesters want parliamentary elections postponed. Not far away, a small counter-demonstration was held in support of the military and the elections. More than 40 people were killed earlier this week as the security forces tried to break up the massive protests. But now a truce seems to have ended the clashes, and a carnival atmosphere returned to the demonstrations on Friday. People were letting off fireworks and shouting, "Down with the military regime!" They want military rule to end before parliamentary elections are held. The Tahrir Square protests, which are backed by some trade unions, have been called a Last Chance Friday rally to demand an immediate transfer of power from the military. Note that the U.S. has long maintained extremely close relations with Egypt's military, oblivious to democracy or human rights. And from Antiwar.com on November 25th. The week-long protests in Tahrir Square have returned to the level of the anti-Mubarak revolution earlier this year today, with over 100,000 protesters rallying to condemn the Egyptian military junta. The protesters object to the government's confusing and drawn-out election schedule, as well as plans to include unchecked military power in the new constitution. And from Antiwar.com on November 23rd. Violence continued in Syria today, with more protesters killed. The focus, however, was off the coast, where America's newest aircraft carrier, the USS George H.W. Bush, has taken up a position just outside of Syrian territorial waters, after a deployment near the Straits of Hormuz off Iran. There was no official explanation for why the U.S. would deploy the carrier there, but it comes amid growing speculation that NATO ally Turkey is poised to launch an invasion of Syria, and the possibility that a U.S.-backed regime change may be in the offing. And from Antiwar.com on November 18th. Russian warships are en route to Syrian territorial waters in a move that sends a clear message from Moscow that they would not allow any foreign intervention into Syria's civil unrest. NATO spokespeople have so far denied any intention to intervene in Syria. And from Foreign Policy Magazine on November 22nd. When people read a news website, they don't usually imagine that it is being run by a major producer of fighter jets and smart bombs. But when the Pentagon has its own vision of America's foreign policy and the funds to promote it, it can put a $23 billion defense contractor in the unique position to report on the war on terror. Over the past 3 years, a subdivision of Virginia-based General Dynamics has set up and run a network of 8 so-called influence websites, funded by the Defense Department with more than $120 million in taxpayer money. The sites focus on geographic areas under the purview of various U.S. combatant commands, including the U.S. Central Command. In its coverage of Uzbekistan, a repressive dictatorship increasingly important to U.S. military goals in Afghanistan, a website called Central Asia Online has shown a disturbing tendency to downplay the autocracy's rights abuses and uncritically promote its claims of terrorist threats. Central Asia Online was created in 2008, a time when Washington's ability to rely on Pakistan as a partner in the U.S.-led operation in Afghanistan was steadily waning. In the search for alternative land routes to supply U.S. troops, Uzbekistan seemed the best option. Its infrastructure, used by the Soviets to get in and out of Afghanistan during their ill-fated war there, was far superior to that of neighboring Tajikistan. Today, the U.S. military moves massive amounts of cargo across Uzbekistan. By year's end, the Pentagon hopes to see 3/4 of all non-lethal military supplies arrive in Afghanistan by the so-called Northern Distribution Network. Gas-rich Uzbekistan has long been ruled by strongman Islam Karimov, who is regularly condemned in the West for running one of the world's most repressive and corrupt regimes. Freedom House gives Uzbekistan the lowest possible score in its Freedom in the World report, while watchdog groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have reported on widespread torture and forced child labor. They also hold more political prisoners than all other post-Soviet republics combined. In the past, Karimov has responded to U.S. criticism over human rights by threatening to shut down the supply route to Afghanistan. In 2005, after Washington demanded an investigation into the massacre of hundreds of civilians in the eastern city of Andijan, he closed an American airbase. So Washington's expressions of disapproval have given way to praise. In September, Secretary of State Clinton cautiously commended its alleged progress on political freedoms, and President Obama moved to end restrictions on military aid in place since 2004. And with those restrictions lifted, General Dynamics stands to profit. The company has already shown interest in finding clients in Central Asia, hawking its wares at a defense exposition in Kazakhstan last year. This potential self-interest casts an unflattering light on Central Asia Online's flattering coverage of the region's calcified dictatorships. For instance, take a March story praising Uzbek efforts to register religious groups. The story does not mention reputable organizations' allegations about arbitrary arrests of Christians and Muslims from unregistered groups, but cites state-affiliated clergy lauding the country's religious freedom. The story ends by saying, quote, Uzbekistan is doing everything necessary to ensure its citizens have the proper conditions to exercise freedom of conscience. That is patently not so, according to an Oslo-based religious freedom watchdog. And from antiwar.com and Haaretz on November 24th. Israeli NGO report details government subsidies for settlements. A report from the pro-settler NGO Matat Arim has revealed exactly how broad the Israeli government's policies of subsidizing the settlements in the occupied West Bank are. The report revealed a number of unpublicized moves by the Knesset to support the growth of the settlements. In other words, the U.S. government gives a lot of money to the Israeli government, and they then give a lot of that money to develop illegal settlements on occupied land, which they are supposedly trying to dismantle. And from antiwar.com on November 23rd, Pakistan's parliament has announced that they intend to collect data about civilian deaths in the U.S. drone strikes against Pakistani territory, and will submit the data as part of a complaint to the UN Human Rights Council. The drone campaign began in the waning hours of George W. Bush's second term, but dramatically escalated when President Obama took office, to the point where they have killed thousands, including massive numbers of unidentified suspects. And in this breaking news, that apparently includes Pakistani troops. From the BBC on November 26th. Pakistani officials have responded with fury to an apparent attack by NATO helicopters on an Afghan border checkpoint they say killed 26 soldiers. The unprovoked and indiscriminate attack took place in Momand tribal region, the Pakistani military said. Prime Minister Gilani called it outrageous and convened an emergency meeting of the cabinet. A foreign ministry statement said it was taking up the matter with NATO and the U.S., quote, in the strongest terms. Within hours of the attack, it was reported Pakistan had closed the border crossing for supplies bound for NATO forces in Afghanistan. In other words, the Khyber Pass. There have been several incidents over the last 3 or 4 years in which NATO helicopters are said to have carried out attacks on Pakistani border checkpoints. On those occasions, NATO has come back with the explanation that soldiers were mistaken for insurgents, saying there was insurgent activity in those areas at the time. But furious Pakistani officials insist there was no militant activity in the area at the time, so this was not a case of mistaken identity. A senior Pakistani military officer told Reuters, quote, The latest attack by NATO forces on our post will have serious repercussions as they, without any reasons, attacked our post and killed sleeping soldiers. Some reports suggest that more than one checkpoint was attacked, considering that most checkpoints would not be manned by more than 10 or 15 men, so the high death tolls point to more than one target. The U.S. has been targeting militants in Pakistan's tribal areas near the Afghan border for months, often using unmanned drone aircraft. And finally, from the BBC on November 25th. This is another BBC story that took a lot of editing to make any sense. UN member states have rejected a US-backed plan to regulate but legalize cluster bombs. A total of 111 UN member states have already signed up to the Oslo Convention prohibiting the production, transfer, and use of cluster munitions. The US, Russia, and China have not. The plan would have eliminated all cluster munitions made before 1980. But human rights groups argued that an international convention banning such bombs already exists and that the new protocol would dilute its provisions. Many UN member states felt that getting rid of some cluster weapons while officially sanctioning others would set a dangerous precedent and might even legitimize their use in the long term. The US said it was deeply disappointed by the decision. A senior US official said the bombs were a military necessity. The outcome of Friday's meeting in Geneva was welcomed by human rights campaigners who said cluster bombs are indiscriminate weapons that can fail to explode on impact and lie dormant, often causing injury to civilians years after a conflict has ended. Steve Goose of Human Rights Watch said, quote, How often do you see the U.S., Russia, China, India, Israel, and Belarus push for something and they don't get it? This has happened largely because of one powerful alliance driving the Oslo partnership. Even military allies of the U.S., like Britain, chose not to support the U.S. initiative. The U.S. proposal was also opposed by the International Committee of the Red Cross.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for that news we need to know here on Making Waves. And now for a song by Jim Scott, Nothing We Haven't Seen Before.
Thank you. from covert conflict to open wars, area prone to domination, little hope for repatriation. So much pain and so much tears, so the lessons can fall on deaf ears. At what cost the war is won? Well, it's all over, but the revision's just begun. Everything looks different, but you're just the same. Still looking for someone else to blame. Whispered words of what is fair, drown in the silence of despair. All wisdom and advice falls short of help. A mirror's no use until you can recognize yourself. You were trying to find that flag of truce, even as the bridges burn. Well, it's all over, but the second thoughts await their turn. Drawn. The wounded search for meaning, the proud move on. Dreams were dashed and trust was broken. Fate so bound in words unspoken. Do you pick the rubble for what might have been? No one in their right mind would want to feel that way again. As the clock waits to extract its toll, the credits fade and the regrets start to roll. So frustration found release. Did anyone remember to speak for peace? Was it for law and order that rights were wrong? In the name of justice, the war prolonged. Yet through it all, some greater love was grown. And weren't there moments beyond anything you've known?
That was Jim Scott singing Nothing We Haven't Seen Before. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Now we bring you the latest fortnightly rant from the New Hampshire Gazette, the nation's oldest newspaper, which is based in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. This rant, Reasons to Be Cheerful, from November 18, 2011, will now be read by its editor, Stephen Fowell.
In this, the only world we have, we mere humans, being both mortal and finite, are at an enormous disadvantage. Corporations, though, appear to have no natural limits as to size, and if they can engineer enough taxpayer bailouts, they may be immortal as well. It's no consolation that corporations are an invention of humans. So are landmines, nerve gas, and H-bombs. If we could ever accurately calculate the proportion of human ideas that turn out to be terrible, we might be tempted to outlaw invention. Neither does it come as any comfort that corporations are run by humans. Norway was nominally run by a human named Vidkun Quisling. His death before a firing squad, to the extent that it's remembered, remains unlamented. Corporations are required by their charters to maximize shareholder value. In effect, this means that they are obliged to behave in a psychopathic manner. If a company can make a killing in the first quarter of a fiscal year by ending the world in the last, that's good business, which is why many of them are busily converting both the atmosphere and the oceans into poison. No single corporation could colonize the Earth by itself. It seems, though, that they cannot resist the temptation to do it together. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce probably has a position paper somewhere claiming that competition is the very soul of the market. It has lies for every occasion. Coca-Cola and Pepsi are perceived as rivals, but if voters somehow euchred Congress into banning corporate sales of carbonated sugar water, the truth would soon come out. They have more in common with each other than they do with their customers. When attacked, they circle the wagons and defend each other. The interlocking interests of these immortal psychopathic beasts, as interpreted by the generously compensated Quislings who run them, are the force that ultimately drives the world's public policies right into the ground. Even so, there are reasons to be not just thankful, but cheerful. The ancient Romans believed that whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. Those gods must be on the side of the humans because the party most enthralled to the corporations has clearly lost its collective mind. CNN's Monica Crowley recently quizzed Republican Party Chairman Reince Priebus on the polling numbers showing that 69% of the public believe that the policies of the GOP in Congress favor the rich. Priebus claimed that it's not true, the party doesn't favor the rich. Anyone who believes that, or expects anyone else to believe it, is certifiably insane. Michelle Bachmann, formerly a frontrunner for her party's presidential nomination, suggested on Sunday that the U.S. should ditch its un-American programs like Medicare and Medicaid and emulate China instead. Rick Perry briefly followed Bachmann as the party's Not Romney darling. His star quickly sank thanks to his bipolar performance. Wooden in debates, but suspiciously liquid while speaking before a family values audience. His poll ratings, when he suffered near-fatal brain freeze in a debate on November 9th, dropped from high to mid-single digits. Incredibly, not one of the liberal media's character assassins thought to bring up the famous 3 a.m. phone call which Hillary Clinton would have been unprepared to answer. Meanwhile, Herman Cain, the current non-Romney, has introduced a new gambit to the old game, the Charlton Heston card. "I prayed and prayed and prayed," he said, describing his decision to run for president. "And when I finally realized that it was God saying that this is what I needed to do, I was like Moses. 'You've got the wrong man, Lord. Are you sure?'" Whoa, stop the presses. This just in. Cain's numbers are dropping, and Newt Gingrich is the new non-Romney. Turns out the Republicans believe in recycling after all. Oops. Spoke too soon. Gingrich said during a recent debate that he earned a $300,000 fee to advise Freddie Mac as a historian who warned that the mortgage company's business model was insane. Bloomberg reports he was actually asked to build bridges to Republican lawmakers and develop an argument on behalf of the company's public-private structure that would resonate with conservatives seeking to dismantle it. Clearly, the Republicans desperately need help. Here's a free want ad from the Gazette. Wanted: credible presidential candidate. Contact Republican National Committee. No Romneys need apply.
Thanks to Stephen Fowle for reading us his latest fortnightly rant from the New Hampshire Gazette, the nation's oldest newspaper, based in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. To find out more about the New Hampshire Gazette, including subscription info, see www.nhg.org. nhgazette.com. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. And now for Sharon Birch singing Sacred Wind. That was Sharon Birch singing Sacred Wind. Here on Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. During this after Thanksgiving weekend, we have been contemplating both the true history of Native and settler relations, and also more current issues on this topic. What we've chosen to bring you next on today's show is about what we have to learn from Native peoples, including the fact that each one of us come from people who were once Native to a place. So let's listen to this Bioneer special on indigeneity, becoming Native to our place.
Welcome to the Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
We can't continue to be just transient. We can't continue just to do this and then fly away and leave it there for somebody else to clean up or somebody else to worry about or somebody else to vote on. Indigeneity means that we have to re-indigenize ourselves.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Scientists tell us that concern with the environment will no longer be just one of many issues in this new century. It will move to center stage. It will become the context of everything, of our lives, our businesses, our politics. We are, in fact, moving from the information age to the age of biology. In this series, The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, we salute the bioneers, the biological pioneers who are working with nature to heal nature, honoring both traditional Native wisdom and modern scientific knowledge, restoring the earth by changing the world. This house, this neighborhood, these people, this town. How many of us can say that the house we live in is the home we grew up in? How many of us consider ourselves Native to where we live? We've been called the leaving culture. Janine Benyus, in her work with biomimicry, likens modern Western civilization to a weedy culture. We behave like invasive weeds. We drop our seeds, sponge up the resources to quickly produce the next crop of seeds, then disperse them on the next wind to plow up the next ground. The leaving culture is perpetually restless. With its eyes darting for the next exploitable moment, it is near blind to what is here now, what is at hand, what is at its feet. With its eyes to what's over the next hill, to where the grass appears greener, it hasn't had time to learn to read what this land has written, what this land is saying. That illiteracy could be our undoing. There are peoples who have long been becoming Native to a place, seeing how the land wants people to be, here and now, so that tomorrow comes in a good way. They are First Nations peoples. Whereas so many others have come and gone, First Nations are still in their place, still learning from the holy land under their feet. Join us for the next half hour as we explore indigeneity, becoming Native, staying Native, with Leslie Gray, Jeanette Armstrong, and Gucci Cook. I'm Neil Harvey. I'll be your host. Welcome to the Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
A basic question I invite students to ask themselves is, where is the Holy Land?
Leslie Gray is an Oneida Seminole psychologist. She is the founder of the Woodfish Institute and teaches at the University of California at Berkeley and at the California Institute of Integral Studies.
I invite you now to ask yourself, where is the Holy Land? It can sound very strange to an Indian person to hear non-Indian people refer to the Middle East as the Holy Land. This is the Holy Land. This is where Onondaga is. The sacred council fire burns at Onondaga still. This is where the Black Hills are, the traditional vision questing place of black elk, lame deer, and many others. This is where pilgrims crawl on their knees to be healed at Chimayo. This is where the spiritual city at Chaco Canyon was constructed with every point in alignment with the heavens. This is where Blue Lake is. This is where Big Mountain is. This is the Holy Land. Of course, all over the planet, you will find sacred sites that were honored and preserved by the indigenous people of that bioregion. And of course, everywhere you step on the sacred bones of ancestors. So this is the Holy Land, right here, the dirt right here under this building in San Rafael, California. Why is it important to feel the sacredness of the land you are on? Because at the dawn of the 21st century, people are still going to war over the idea that one spot in the Middle East is the Holy Land. Or another way to say it is that it is still possible for a few people interested in domination and power to bamboozle the many who only see one place and one religion based on the spiritual story of that place as sacred. And here in the U.S., where the prevailing culture still clings to a narrow conception of a distant holy land, the public is easily bamboozled into war for control of distant natural resources. So there is a very high cost indeed for failing to acknowledge the whole earth as sacred.
What if every decision we made grew out of the understanding that the whole earth is sacred? If we held all the earth as sacred, not just mine or my community's land, but yours as well, your lawn, your driveway, your sidewalk, as sacred as mine, your fields, your water, your sky, even your shrine, as important as mine? Simply considering that the ground under our feet, everywhere, is somehow holy ground, is a challenging proposition. The difficulty to even imagine it may indicate the distance we are from being native to this place, from our indigeneity.
I wanted to talk about the idea of indigeneity. I wanted to make sure I include my understanding of that.
Jeanette Armstrong is an award-winning Okanagan Canadian author and artist whose works include children's books, the novels Slash and Whispering in the Shadows, poetry, video, and TV productions. She is a council member of the Okanagan Nation and an internationally recognized advocate of indigenous rights. She spoke at a recent Bioneers conference.
I was thinking about it in terms of if I were to look at that and give it a description in my language, how would I put that description together? And one of the things that occurred to me is that we as human beings belong to the earth. We're an integral part of the earth, and that in some ways we don't understand and appreciate how we changed from being indigenous to non-indigenous and what occurred in that process to separate those two ideas. For me, what it means is that I know where my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother has been. And on my land, I can point to it. I can walk to it. I can, you know, I can talk to it in the same language that my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother talked to it in. And I can be familiar with it in that particular way, that the familiarity of those things that are on my land that surround me isn't just a physical familiarity, that the familiarity with the land is that the land teaches us over generation upon generation upon generation how we should be on that land. In other words, the land itself asks us to be a certain way in order for us and it to be healthy. And to me, that's what indigenous and indigeneity means. And you can call that spirituality, or you can call that social practice, or you can call it culture. Whatever words you want to conjure up for it, it still comes down to the same thing. It comes down to how we respect each other and love each other and care for each other, and how we're willing to move aside for each other and include each other and take care of each other. It all comes down to that. That's not an easy thing to practice when You're in conflict with each other. That's not an easy thing to practice when you're in competition with each other. And I think the paradigm of competition for resources, the competition for space, the competition for all of these things that we yearn for, that we want for ourselves, leads us to this place where we're at. Rather than making room for each other's needs, whether they be economic, whether they be cultural, or whether they be emotional, all of those parts in our society impact the land. When you look at what is at the bottom of that need to control resources, that need to hold exclusive certain parts of it for my exclusive use or that person's exclusive use. And I know that sounds really simplistic. We can't just, you know, ask everybody to move over. But I think in a lot of ways, what some of our peoples have carried forward with them are processes that work, that help us do that, that help us to remind each other and remind ourselves that we need to behave in certain ways and that we have some really good constructs that can help with that.
Jeanette Armstrong says that indigeneity comes down to how we respect each other, love each other, and take care of each other. In the native way, competition gives way to making room for each other's needs. These sound like high ideals, but how might a pioneer bring the principles of indigeneity into one's personal life, organization, community, and nation?
I use an example from our community, what we're beginning to call the Four Societies process, but it's part of the work that I'm involved in the Anaucan Center. The Anaucan Center itself describes that process. The word itself comes from our high language, the language of the Okanagan. It describes a governance process. And it describes a process in which we actively seek to find the most dissident voice, the most diverse voice, and it asks us and requires us to try to understand that by any means we can, by listening, by art, by communication, by seeking clarity. But it puts the responsibility on me. It says that if I don't understand what you're saying, it's my responsibility to find a way to find out. It's not your responsibility to try to figure out how come I don't know it or how come I don't understand it. It's my responsibility. And in the same way, if there's conflict between us and I don't know how to resolve that, then it's my responsibility to find a way to resolve that, to find a way, any which way I can, to engage myself responsibly to be able to find out why the conflict is there and to find what your needs are that have created that conflict and to find ways in which creatively I can construct or change or find solutions within whatever I am empowered to do that, and that if I don't do that, then I'm making problems for myself, that it's going to impact me. And so in the Anaucan process, what we do in our communities is a process that says that there are different components to our communities. There's sort of a natural process of dividing it into four components. And if you think about those components being diametrically sort of in opposition to each other, continuously in a community, then if you think about the dynamics of bringing those opposites into equilibrium to work with each other and fuel the ongoing health, then you have solidarity in a community. You don't have everybody agreeing with each other, but you have solidarity in terms of what we agree that we can do about the things we disagree on. And so that kind of collaboration and consensus making is a process that embraces diversity and supports diversity and celebrates diversity, but also seeks the balance, the natural balance of how that diversity can coexist and cooperate for all of our health and well-being. And I think out of that comes a really good reconciliation process or conflict resolution process. So I have used it in conflict resolution, and it works. It works.
Jeanette Armstrong. Moving toward indigeneity from Leslie Gray's and Jeanette Armstrong's perspective would be moving toward the view that all land is holy land, that we humans belong to the earth does not belong to us. As there have been many before us, we would do well to remember the many who will follow us, and competition is best when it yields to inclusivity. The inclusivity Jeanette Armstrong describes engages and embraces diversity. It is like an ecosystem, and like an ecosystem, there is struggle. It's not all sweetness and light. An indigenous inclusivity does not mean that all the colors melt into one, like white. Again, Leslie Gray.
If you meet Native American people who cling to their worldview and preserve their traditions, they had to work very hard to do it. And maybe that's the thing to take away from this. Don't participate in the myth of whiteness. There is no such thing. It's simply a political construct to retain domination. Every single person in the world has an ethnicity. Ethnic does not mean colored or being a person of color. Ethnicity is your culture, and it's your culture as it relates to a particular place on earth, a particular bioregion, a particular land. And everyone can trace those roots back for themselves. And the most radical thing you could do is to start thinking of yourself as having come from some place in this land. And that thought alone is going to be a huge contradiction to the domination of whiteness.
Leslie Gray challenges her students to identify themselves with a specific place on the land. A reconnection to our roots in today's unrooted world is one of the most radical acts we can perform, she says. In fact, if we trace our own roots back far enough, we find that all of us were once indigenous. Connecting to place can deepen a sense of who we are. Connecting to place can deepen a sense of who we all are. When we return, Gudjie Cook describes her first experience in the Mohawk Longhouse. This is Indigeneity, Becoming Native, Staying Native. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. Gudjie Cook, a Wolf Clan Mohawk, offered that song at a recent Bioneers conference. She's director field coordinator of the Lewirokwas program of Running Strong for American Indian Youth. She is a practitioner and teacher of Aboriginal midwifery. Gudjie Cook.
Our people are far from intact. I was educated by Catholic nuns. My mother's first cousin, who in the Indian way would be my uncle, was the first or second ordained Jesuit missionary, Native American in this whole hemisphere, who told me, you go in that longhouse, you're going to go to hell. And when I was 15 years old, by then both my parents had gone on to the spirit world. And so I had the freedom to do and think the way I chose. And I went in that longhouse and sat through an Ogiwe ceremony. When the buds are new on the trees in the spring, That's the time the clan mothers call together the singers to sing about 200 lines of songs that call the spirits of our dead people from the woods and from the streams, and we sit and eat and dance and sing to them all night. And when we dance, we leave a space in between, and they come and they dance with us. That's how, one of the ways we deal with grief, because grief itself is an illness, a sickness. And so we do that every spring and every fall. And through the night, just from the act of doing, I learned what that meant to be Ongwehunwe, a real person. In the morning, all the lights out, they did a stomp dance where we wove into a coil tight like a snake and then broke out and went out the east women's door back around the longhouse, the clan mothers carrying bags of fruits and small ribbons, throwing it in the air. What we could catch like little kids was for us. What fell to the earth was for her. I was so moved by what I had seen. I walked 15 miles just thinking about what went on and realizing all my life I'd been told, be proud you're an Indian, be proud you're a Mohawk, but don't speak your language, but don't go to the longhouse, but go off and become like a white professional. And so I had to integrate the reality that my father was one of a handful of Native graduates from Dartmouth College, 1949, whose plane crashed getting ready for the Korean conflict. He was a fighter pilot in World War II, Purple Heart, decorated hero, American flag all the way. He should have survived but didn't. And my mother, in spite of her devout Catholicism, still put sweet flag on the window and gave us Indian medicine and still spoke her language. And underneath, hidden under all of that, is the Mohawk ways. And so I grew up with both, and I learned how to be respectful of both, because we have a great spiritual diversity in our community. Some people really believe the only way to God is through a man named Jesus. And myself, I have a different vision of what our life on earth is about than always thinking about somewhere over there. Because to me, this is heaven. We are here in heaven. Suffering is a part of it. I like how Patrick Carnes, who's a psychotherapist that works in Phoenix, Arizona, his research described the field of sexual addiction. He's a Catholic. He said, if we are made in the image of God, then God too suffers. And that was a really beautiful thing to hear. But the integration of our knowledge with the Western, pure science is very spiritual to me. I had a microscope when I was 9 years old. I lived in my grandma's house. We didn't have TV or radio. You could hear the clock ticking. It was a very boring place to be. And so I'd go out to the woods and I'd go out to the meadows, and it was there I learned how to think in both ways.
Mohawk midwife Gudji Cook. Again, here's Okanagan Canadian author Jeanette Armstrong.
When I was saying this morning about Okanaganizing people, I really mean that. I really mean that in the Okanagan, that people need to learn how to behave with each other in a way which is going to be regenerative to the land and which gives people the internal need and love to care for each other the way the land needs them to care for each other. And that if we can entice people to love the land that much and love each other that much, they're not going to go anywhere. And not going anywhere for a number of generations gives the kind of ethic that's really needed for that kind of sustainability. That's what localizing is about. Everybody needs to think about localizing transgenerationally and doing that in the best way possible. And to me, that's what re-indigenizing means. It's really an important principle in terms of what is needed on the land and how the land needs us to be. We can't continue to be just transient We can't continue just to do this and then fly away and leave it there for somebody else to clean up or somebody else to worry about or somebody else to vote on. Indigeneity means that we have to re-indigenize ourselves. I think some Native American leader I heard said, we have to Americanize the white man.
When did it happen? When did we stop being native to this place? Jeanette Armstrong, Gudjie Cook, and Leslie Gray are not urging everyone to become Indians. Just to think of ourselves as having come from some place, our place on the land, is a step toward the indigenous. There is a respect that can come from rootedness, they say. A quiet and tenacious inclusivity can grow. With a little time, the lessons of the land can be seen, worked out in the shapes of trees, the swirls in river eddies, and markings on rock faces. If we slow our weedy impulses, stop and stay a while, those clues written in the migration of birds or the hibernating practice of bears might work on shaping who we are and how we might continue to be a part of the earth in a good way. Those clues might lead us from the leaving culture to the Holy Land under our feet. Indigeneity, becoming native, staying native.
Many thanks to Bioneers for that program on indigeneity, becoming native to our place, which we were pleased to air during this after Thanksgiving weekend to highlight the voices of Native people speaking out now. Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our ending music is Avalon by Amethystium. You can live stream our show if you are not in range of the station by going to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org. Remember that WSCA is your community radio station and needs your support to remain on the air. Go to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org to join and learn more. Ongoing technical improvements for Making Waves also need your help. Go to our website to find out how, www.nhmakingwaves.org. Tune in next Saturday for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by the Brule Lakota writer and activist Mary Bravebird. The land is sacred. These words are at the core of your being. The land is our mother. The rivers are blood. Take our land away and we die. That is, the Indian in us dies.